Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Pentagram, dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal form, the born of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horde. Man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein. Man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam. He harnessed the lightning for hire. He drove the celestial team. And man was the lord of the fire. Deep mouth.
Well, 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 my friends, this is episode 66 of Agitators Anonymous, and I am Alan Averill. I've spent a week off the grid, and I recommend you all, if you can, try and put down your weapon of choice and get off from behind the screen and go and try and do a little bit of living with the people that you kind of like, maybe you love, who don't annoy you too much. What can I say? Or maybe that manage to tolerate you. Whatever, whomever, however, this is Agitators Anonymous. Now, this is going to be an interesting episode in that I'm getting a lot of questions from people for the last couple of weeks, a lot of direct messages. I'm doing a lot of sort of bonus Q&A podcasts on my Patreon because, oddly enough, a lot of the things that I've been talking about for the last year and a half are starting to fall kind of into place. And a lot of people who are doubting Thomases are going, really? Oh, okay, so, huh? Etc., etc. So this is going to be the audio of an interview I did with the Into the Necrosphere podcast. There's quite a few metal podcasts popping up here and there, and they don't really cross-pollinate. It's one thing I've noticed, for example, about comedy podcasts or this kind of thing is they all have each other on each other's podcasts. You know this if you're used to watching. We all started maybe watching the Joe Rogan podcast, but you'll notice he's been the kingmaker of many a comedian, etc., etc. And metal and music, if you look at the top 100 podcasts, there's precious few that are done by musicians. That's just the way things are. And generally, when we release an album, you know, with Dread Sovereign, there's press a lot, not as much as when there is a primordial album, but there's not that many podcasts that I do interviews with. However, this one was definitely worth sharing, cross-pollinating, so to speak, on my own podcast. It was a very long, very interesting, very engaging, kind of fiery chat I had with Into the Necrosphere podcast. So what I'm going to do is this is going to be an interview with me by Into the Necrosphere. There's a lot of things, I suppose, that people have been messaging me about for the last while, addressed within it. And, of course, it's done in a sort of obviously, it's an interview, so it's not just me speaking into the ether. So things are being batted back and forward. There's a bit of confrontation. There's some fiery stuff going on, as I said. And I just thought that maybe once I looked over the audio of this, I thought this is something that I should put on my podcast. And like I said, I've been off the grid for a week, so normal service of my bitterness and grumpiness will be resumed next week, as I got a lot of things to say about what's going on. Anyway, So episode 66 will be a chat between me and Jackie from Into the Necrosphere. Go and support his podcast and his YouTube channel. This will not appear as video format on my YouTube channel. You may go and have a look at the video on Into the Necrosphere's YouTube channel, but it will be up as an audio on my YouTube channel. And there's more things coming there as well soon as we head into another autumn of could be sort of lockdown. Guess we have to see. Right, I'm in an annoying mood and I'm obviously annoying everybody. Let's get on with it. Interview with Into the Necrosphere, episode 66.
That was actually one of the reasons I was keen to talk to you. I mean, I'm a big fan of Primordial anyway, but you know, you've been one of the probably the most outspoken free thinkers in the scene, I think, you know, and given the, you know, your podcast, you have a platform to be able to do that as well. But I think it's been very refreshing to see somebody like you kind of stand up and speak out over the last, 12 to 15 months, in a sea of, you know, what I think are often well-intentioned, but not very well thought out opinions, if you know what I mean.
I mean, you know, the reality is that the format of doing something like a podcast or speaking, anybody who knows me knows that I generally have a lot to say. And the fact that it's a perfect medium doing the podcast. But yeah, I mean, within 2 weeks of this happening, this whole emergency, I sort of said to myself, right, I'm going to die. I think I know what's going to happen. And I better start, speaking out honestly about it, trying to be a rational perspective on things, hold the line for somewhere in the middle between each sides of the argument, but also try an approach. Well, I consider skepticism to always be the rational perspective on every single thing, to never assume good faith behalf of the institutions of power and state. That's just a naivety on a scale that misreads history that I just can't comprehend. And so it suits me to do this. But yes, I agree with you. There's been a dearth of people, voices who, and I don't even consider myself to be particularly extreme in my opinions. I just consider them to be trying to literally sort of step outside of the emotional bubble that most people view things, or, as I said, to not take things on face value as being, why would institutions of power and state and pharma and agency give a shit about you? They don't.
Yeah.
They never did. Yeah. So, look, it's been a weird situation, but, and I think I've probably tried to hold the line with presenting some of the views that I would put less faith in as well, but it's been strange, but not many musicians have been speaking out about what's going on. Not even in context of how all this affects the music industry, which, let's be honest, it kills, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I want to talk about the music industry as well, but I think first of all, just on a, sorry, I, I was just going to say on a purely, you know, human level, how have you been doing, outside of the podcast, what have you been doing to keep yourself sane over the last, 15 months?
I've been doing a lot of running. In Ireland, they put padlocks on sports pitches. So there was a huge period of time, 5 or 6 months, where they wouldn't open gyms. You couldn't literally go and play football. People were scared into not doing that. So I put my time into the podcast, writing some other music, but it's been very difficult, especially living in the center of a city. If you were out in the countryside, there were certain amenities and I suppose rural ways of living that allowed you to be insulated from some of the effects of the pandemic. But living in a city, it sort of affects everything. For the first few months, like Dublin was literally like 28 days later. It's just homeless people and junkies everywhere. And just people camping, everywhere in all the kind of, doorways of buildings. And yeah, it was pretty grim. Things have opened, things have changed a little bit. The city is a little bit more life. But I mean, if you walk down, anybody's visited Dublin, if you walk down Grafton Street, 60, 70% of the buildings are not just closed, but derelict. So the implications for city living in a post, well, I mean, people say post, but I don't believe that that really was going to happen.
The new normal.
Yeah, are very, very, they're very profound. You know, if you have a house in the countryside, and of course, don't forget, many of the people making the decisions that affect how we all live through this, not only, of course, are in very obviously the bankroll of big pharma, but these are very often middle-class people who have the garden to be insulated from this. Go to a like working class area down the road here, and people are cooped up like fucking battery chickens, you know, and you expect them to cope with all of this in the same manner. Obviously, look, you don't expect that because, as we've established, no one gives a shit, but you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've experienced both ends of the stick. I lived in Kingston, in kind of on the outskirts of London, for 5 years. Last year in October, we decided that my girlfriend's family have a piece of land outside of basically between Oxford and Newbury, where she keeps her horses. There's like a small little, you know, I'd say probably like a granny flat, a little bigger than a granny flat, on the property. And we decided we're going to move there. You know, I can carry, you know, I can, it doesn't matter where I'm based. I can work wherever I want to work. And, you know, over a year we're kind of rent free, but at the same time, the other big benefit of it is, to your point, when the kind of post or the Christmas lockdown kicked in, I didn't really feel it. You know, as long as I could still go to Costco and, you know, get something to throw on the barbecue, it didn't affect me nearly as much as it did when we were in Kingston, way over there. It's exactly as you say, everything is desolate. You know, you kind of see one after the other shop not being able to stay open, you know, restaurants shutting down, everything just kind of grounds to a halt. And, you know, my big concern is, you've mentioned this on your podcast too, I can already see them setting the table and laying the groundwork for the next big lockdown, the Delta variant. Sure. There always seems to be another variant, but the variant always seems to replace the flu cases that have suddenly dropped en masse in a particular country. And I'm noticing, you know, I'm from South Africa originally. I'm noticing back home in South Africa, there's another lockdown now. They're talking about locking down, you know, all of Australia. There's parts that are already locked down. It's winter over there. So my immediate thinking is, how many misdiagnosed flu cases are being reported as COVID over there, and all of a sudden it's hysteria? And so are we going to go through this endless cycle every single winter when as soon as flu season kicks in, well, this must be another variant. It's got, you know, some symptoms of COVID, which on, you know, as an aside, the symptoms appear to be so broad. I mean, I actually had COVID and I had, I mean, my problem started with having, you know, stomach issues. I thought I had a stomach bug. Finally got tested, and it turned out that I had COVID. But yeah, anyway, I'm kind of going off on a tangent. But you kind of get what I mean.
Well, I mean, the thing that people have to, I mean, the thing that I always say about literally everything is that, the idea that there's one narrative is naive and ill-informed. There are, if we say, for example, how did the First World War start? You could say it was, you know, about Gabriella Princip shooting Archduke Ferdinand, etc. But there are many, many points that lead up to that. There's many other, there's thousands of books written with different angles to it. You know, the idea that there's only ever one narrative is a misreading of history. And so when I say to friends of mine who like have just been like, trust the HSE, trust the health services, follow the science, and you just go, look, there are other narratives at play. Anyone who says that there is not an element of this that is about social control is just wrong. Mm. There always is. The idea of a biometric passport, which I was talking about in podcast one, which is 18 months ago, that is an element, can be used as an element of social control. Like in the UK, restrictions on protesting is an element of social control. So anyone who adheres to one single narrative, and I include the people who would be called conspiracy theorists, are on the far end of it, of either side. I don't really think the political, this political spectrum really relates to how you view those things, but is wrong. There are multiple narratives all playing out. There are irrational, rational actors, different agents, all moving towards different things. And sometimes they coalesce to have, I suppose, a common objective. And there are certainly a massive transfer of power and wealth that has occurred during lockdown. It's clear that Big Pharma has now created basically a health tax through which they can implement on the world at the behest of big tech, which will censor opposing voices. and the state and government, who, let's be honest, I think rather prefer a country where people are consuming through fear inside their own four walls.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's a controversial opinion. I think anybody, the kind of the people who argued with me over this a year ago are very, very quiet. But as a student of history, the idea that there are more than one narratives at play. And also, don't forget, there are some well-meaning people with good intentions who really thought this was a massive disaster. And I suppose on relative terms, it can be seen as that. But of course, once people, let's say, followed the Chinese model of dealing with this out of the gate and realized they could actually lock down Western societies. Don't forget the Robert Koch Institute from Germany in the, let's say, mid to late 2000s, 2007 or 8, had a pandemic plan, which was a cross-European, cross-border European plan for a pandemic. It got thrown out the window within 2 to 3 weeks of the pandemic happening. And it stated within that plan that lockdown was undemocratic and un-Western. And which it is, and here we are, because democracy and civil liberties are suspended and paused. As J.P. Mencken said, the average man doesn't want freedom, he wants to be kept safe, and that's what we found very profoundly during all this. But there are multiple narratives at play. I'm not saying all of them are malign, and all of them are not benign. It's clear that you're talking about people within health service executives who are compromised by their relationship to you know, to big pharma, to these kind of things. And a lot of people, you know, such as the Amazons of this world, are profiting from their being locked down. And also just think about all the human stuff that's involved in this. Politicians who were initially scared, who this is beyond their pay grade, their middle management drones who got where they were by saying yes, but not from critically thinking or analyzing situations like this. It's beyond their pay grade, were scared into doing this. And now they, as human beings, cannot face risk or jeopardy and cannot back out of it. And then in the shadows, a lot of rather authoritarian uniforms have been metaphorically dusted off. And people have gone, wow, this is a great moment to try and take social control. And that's before we even get to, is the Great Reset a thing? Is it not? Is it talk shop of billionaires? I'll tell you what, some of what's happening does look an awful lot like some of that, the restructuring of society. So I'm kind of, what I am is I'm an open skeptic. I always have been towards everything. I have no faith in the institutions of state governance. You know, I have some, but I'm always skeptical of motives of agencies of power. I always have been. This is me. This is not me being me because of the pandemic. I've been like this for 20 odd years, and it infuriates people who know me, but I've always been pedantic to the point of analyzing every moment to make sure it inhabits the gray area, because nothing is absolute on either side except what, death and taxes, I guess. And so that's how I view all of this. And I've been trying to put that into the podcast. Now, to some people who don't want to think like that, it appears extreme, but I don't view it like that at all. To me, as I said, skepticism is the rational perspective and should be for everyone. And so it fascinates me that I have to say to some people, hey, has a bad thing ever happened in history? Yes or yes. Could this be one? Yes or yes. If it is, let's then talk about what it could be. And just those three things, I know it sounds like I'm being a patronizing cunt, but you know, sometimes it has to be that simple.
I was just about to say, I don't think there's anything patronizing about that, to be honest with you, because I feel like one of the things that has become incredibly apparent to me over the course of the past, I mean, I think it's always been there, but I think especially over the course of the past 4 or 5 years is how led by emotion the human race is, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Decisions are not made based on evidence or facts or any kind of critical analysis of something. And as you say, you know, you mentioned the phrase conspiracy theorist earlier.
Yeah.
It feels to me like that phrase has been co-opted to effectively be a cudgel to beat up every single person who dares question anything that they see around them.
Well, put it like this. Let's say post Occupy movement. The people that the Occupy movement rightfully cited as their enemy then co-opted the same movement in the last 10 years through social media, siloed people into their either sides to fight each other, divide and conquer. And so therefore, the idea that they created the idea created almost like a Reddit forum created by state and governance of here's your conspiracy theories. So now everyone who doesn't want to think about the situation that we're in can just go, oh, it sounds like a conspiracy theory. And I go, look, a year and a half ago, you were told it was bats to pangolins to fucking unicorns. And now you get it. Fauci, well, understand. No, you. The euphemistic.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But, and I'm going, I was just about. You get it. Like, Fauci, understand, saying to Rand Paul, yeah, kind of. The leaked emails. People are like, oh, sorry.
Rand Paul has been, he's been given the conspiracy theorist brush. And that's the thing. They tar you with that brush. And then immediately your opinion is moot thereafter. And they very rarely will they retroactively acknowledge, hey, maybe that person had a point. You mentioned the lab leak theory. I mean, that was something that was banned and would get you banned permanently off social media for, you know, a significant portion of the start of the pandemic. But sure. But simply looking at the fact that, you know, the first known variants of the virus, you know, started showing up in December, maybe even earlier in China. They locked down travel from Wuhan anywhere domestically in China, but allowed it to happen externally.
Yeah. The textile workers went to northern Italy.
Yeah. So just looking at that fact, surely you would go, something doesn't add up here.
Yeah. I guess in the 1980s, you think of those things like Union Carbide and stuff like this polluting rivers in India, if I haven't just pulled that out of my gray matter incorrectly. Of course, it's the fucking factory that's making the pollutants that's polluting the river. I mean, isn't it self-evident that somebody would go, yeah, maybe it's that building over there with the thing housed in that building that is actually the thing that's escaped? As, of course, you know, what's his name? has done on the sketch on the late night show. I should have remembered his name before I said that. But it's just basically, I think what happened is this leaked and the virology community. I mean, look, gain of function research was banned under Obama. It seems like Fauci moved it to China. And don't forget, that's not a Chinese thing. That involves people, virologists from lots of areas. It escaped. Here we are. They circled the wagons. People lied to cover, I suppose, grants, funding. Big Pharma could implement a health tax on the world at the behest, as I said, of state and big tech. I mean, that doesn't seem like a crazy thought to me. In fact, that was my thought almost instantly when this happened. And people were like, no, it was a pangolin. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? But here we are. Like I said 18 months ago, I banged the drum and said, watch now what happens. This is exactly what will happen. And, you know, I didn't want to be the cunt that was going like, I fucking told you so. But I'm not that, because I don't want to be right about this, because I want, obviously, things to go back to normal. And I want to have somebody poke me in the ribs and go, you went too far. And give me a beer and go, look, you know, fucking accept is about to play it, bang your head or whatever, which might still happen. And I'm not close to the fact that in 5 months' time, this might have receded into the memory and we might have a momentary 2-year period of complete hysteria and panic, which certain bad actors took advantage of, and that it will recede. Like, I'm not married to the idea that this is the end of social, civic society or culture or whatever. Or, you know, I'm not married to that idea, but I do think that people need to maybe consider some of the broader implications of what's going on, because it's pretty dark stuff. I mean, look, our government here just announced literally the risk from this is open-ended and started talking about flu season. They're not reopening the country. You can't even go inside. Like, they're holding the 4.6 million people at arm's length over modeling that recently just said they 300,000 people could get this by October. And more people could die than the first wave. It's like, where are you getting this modeling? There are zero deaths. There's less than 15 people in ICU in the whole country. Anyway, sorry, I'm rambling on. But
No. You're kind of staying on track, because it's a lot of the same things that I've thought. You know, and as a side note, you know, Fauci to me is just the epitome of The unelected medical official stepping up, one, reveling in the spotlight. You know, he's already obviously got his, well, I don't know whether it's, I think it's been cancelled in the wake of the leaks, but, you know, he's gotten what most, you know, government lackeys get in, you know, as reward for faithful service, which is the book deal. You know, William Barr has just gotten one. Amy Coney Barrett in America has just gotten one as well, worth millions apparently, just to, you know, most likely foment whatever nonsense they want to foment. But Fauci had one. But I mean, you have these people that kind of step up, don't follow their own rules, and then tell the rest of us how to live. And I find it staggering, but not unsurprising, because I understand where people are coming from. There's only so much you can do against the government. But
well, is there?
It's amazing to me how things suddenly just flipped. You know, we're being ruled by people who have no business ruling us.
Yeah.
And well, I think what surprises me is how quickly people accepted it. That to me is the one thing that that I'm still like, because it's not just it's one thing to accept the circumstances, it's another thing to accept the servitude. And the servitude for me is like, It very quickly turned from "this is unfortunate" to "if you don't go with us, you're a scumbag," basically, and you want to kill grandma. You know, so you know, you've mentioned it a second ago as well. You know how people were, you know, surprised about stuff you're saying that now has turned out to be true. You know, again, one of the stuff that they love to label people like you and I with that think slightly differently, or at least would like to think critically about something, is, oh, well, you're far right. I can't believe it. You're one of the far right. You're just like Alex Jones.
Yeah. See, that's if you think about that, that's the perfect divide and conquer. Let's say through social media, the companies that and the multinationals and the agencies, like I said, who were the Occupy movement were against, obviously sat down and thought, how can we co-opt people and divide and conquer? And so through the social media, and some of it was a natural process which created and siloed people into thinking that. And so, yeah, somehow liberty and freedom became the occupation of the far right, which is incredible. But I think that what it's so complicated, but I think an element of the comfort of collectivism appeals to this sort of a kind of socialist mindset that we can see in identity politics or the modern new left, let's say, i.e. that you're in this for the greater good. And so therefore your personal liberty or freedom is can be sacrificed on the altar of the greater good. Now, there is an element, obviously there's a trade-off between those two things. I'm not naive enough to understand that, or to not understand that if this was a very, very serious pandemic, then yes, you would have to trade some of your personal liberty for the greater good. I'm not that naive or stupid, nor do I believe that that's not entirely true to some degree. But once it became clear what this is, then we couldn't peel back. And I think an awful lot of people, once they'd done the emotional lottery of supporting health services in the lockdown, to say to them, hey, you're not going to win. There's no lottery. You can only lose. Once you've emotionally invested in that. Now, I'm not emotionally invested in these arguments because that's not really the kind of person that I am. Whatever the touch of sociopathy that goes with not being emotionally engaged is something that I prize, because I think it gives you a very clear, rational perspective on things regardless. But I think it's just been a classic case of a sort of, you know, Stalin used to say, tell the public something for 2 months and you can have them for 20 years. And I think that there's so many things to unpack with what's been happening. There is an element of society who like this, who are comfortable in this, an element of people who maybe were losing at life, who they now don't have to negotiate the complicated you know, network of interpersonal relationships, of failure, of having a job they hated. And I mean, look, in Ireland, people are being paid the same amount of money to sit at home, smoke weed and play Xbox as they were to accept it from a job they hated. Now, I loved what I was doing, so the fact that mine is gone causes me great fucking existential pain. But for a lot of people, they didn't really give a fuck. They hated their boss. They don't want to fucking work. And I get it. If you were packing shelves and somebody goes, hey, take 2 years off, here's 350 quid a week. Which watch now as that turns into UBI.
Yeah.
Diversified income watch. If those three words come in, you need to worry even more. Yeah. And so there's so much to unpack with what's been happening. But I think you are right in the sense that I've been shocked at how tacit and compliant people have. And it just goes to show you, if you present people with an invisible fear or an invisible enemy, they don't really know how to react. And it piques all of their emotional reactions to what's been happening, and the ability to try and sense make. And also, don't forget, you're trying to sense make of nonsense. The amount of people that said to me, follow the science, and I go, you don't understand what the word fucking science means. Because the concept of science is that it updates itself with its rational observance of empirical data. So the modeling that Neil Ferguson did last March is wrong. You know that's wrong. The modeling of NPHET, our people, our treasonous health officials here, who are obviously in the payroll of, well, to me they are, you know, that should probably get me into trouble. But it's clear.
I was about to say, how dare you?
But no, it's what's clear is that they've just done a modeling which is, it's vast on its scale of how many people are going to get sick. And you're like, hang on, isn't a section of the percentage vaccinated? So what you're saying is that vaccination now doesn't protect people against this new variant that nobody is dying from. And so their modeling data is wrong. Some people tell me, follow the science. And I go, follow the science as sold to you by who? Haven't you been watching the last 18 months and the models have been wrong?
Yeah.
The people who don't understand, again, just like saying conspiracy theorist. And it's like, you're saying the word conspiracy theorist because you don't want to think about this and you want to put me in my place. So I try to say to people, don't be angry at me for the things that I'm saying, even if you agree with the things I'm saying, because you dislike me. Protesting the protester is, again, you know, an intellectual cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
If the greater good is liberty and freedom and trying to understand a situation, put your petty prejudices aside and try and get right to the fucking nub of the issue. Sorry, I'm blah, 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 you know.
No, again,
you've caught me after my fifth cup of coffee. But I do agree with you. We're sitting here with sarcophago and mayhem shirts, and I do find the sort of reticence of the metal community to even discuss it. The virtue signaling going on social media of, oh, I got my vaccine and this kind of stuff.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the inability to kind of rationally observe, like, what's going on. I mean, I've had some music industry chats with a lot of people who are, like, really, really fucking worried, like, we might be done here. But yet that, I don't see those stories in the mainstream media. And certainly in heavy metal media, it's just like, let's just ignore this. Anyway, sorry, I don't know what you were going to say.
No, I want to talk about music in a second, because the infiltration of the virtue signalers and the woke in metal, especially weirdly enough, like black metal and things like that, is, I mean, I find it fucking sickening, to be honest with you, because to me, it's so antithetical to everything that I love about the scene, and it's antithetical to everything that I think the scene should be about. Sorry, you were going to say?
Well, I mean, black metal ruined punks, and punks then set about ruining black metal.
Actually, that's a perfect way to describe it.
Don't get me wrong. I love old punk and stuff, but a whole generation of people who were bored with what punk had to offer because it wasn't offering very much musically kind of looked at black metal and went, wow, Doctor and Burzum is doing something pretty cool. Then they got into the scene and went, oh, look at these idiot moronic heavy metalers. We should set about culturing them and changing their ethics, and which is fine. You can have your Cascadian black metal or your punk black metal, it's fine, no problem. But once you start moving into cancelling bands, being opposed to freedom of speech, I'm a free speech absolutist, because I understand very clearly, even though that has flaws, the alternative is far, far worse. And all the people who advocate for censorship don't really realize that the decision doesn't stop with them.
Yeah.
That the train you've started rolling will eventually come for all the things you love.
Yeah.
That's the nature of the power that is behind that, will come for the things that you love in a free and supposedly democratic society. If you want to live in North Korea or under a communist Eastern rule, then okay, you probably will get your wish and your reward. But go and ask some people who lived under that for 50 years and see how they got along with the Stasi. It's an intellectual cul-de-sac. It's a level of intellectual deceit, cultural deceit. I understand if that's not for you, don't listen to it. If you don't want to go to a show, don't go to it. But it's just, you know, it's antithetical, as you say, to the original blueprint of what that kind of music was. But I understand that in the context of modern society, that it was an inevitability that was going to happen anyway. There is room for all those things. If you want to make, if you want to make this, that, you know, put whatever words in front of your black metal, that's up to you. Do whatever you want. But once you start deciding what other people should or shouldn't hear, look, listen to, I mean, censorship is the cornerstone of tyranny.
Yeah.
And even if you think you're doing some sort of good, you aren't. There's no moment in history where that was ever, you did a good job by censoring the debate, censoring free speech, censoring art, censoring culture, censoring those. You are a willing handmaiden for tyranny. And so while I understand the concept of free speech absolutism has its problems, the problems on the other side are far greater. But I understand for most people, if you're 20 and you think you understand the world and you look at someone like me and go, look at this fucking middle-aged fool, I'm going to show him. I get it. I was 19 at the same time. It's just maybe to have a little bit of foresight. I don't know.
But you and I think, are about 4 years apart. And I've often reflected on this because, look, when I was younger, I know, especially now, I know I was full of shit. And I know that I much of what I know now, or that I could speak to now, I thought very differently when I was young. And it's only through experience and through, you know, knowledge that you develop a better understanding of things, and you develop an understanding of how the world works. But I do feel like social media has done one thing for the, you know, I mean, it's done many things that I think are detrimental to society. But I think when it comes to the youth in particular, it has given them it's created the false sense of certainty amongst them. Like, when I was young, I was full of shit, and maybe part of me didn't realize the extent to how far that went, but I did know, I did have an awareness. Look, I still have a lot to learn. I feel like a lot of the youngsters that I see now, especially in the metal scene, but I mean, it's all over. They seem to sort of have embraced their ignorance as though, you know, this is, I have the answer. This is a fact, and this is the way forward. You know, without naming any names, the number of people that I see, you know, in this little sub segment of metal Twitter, you know, which is the biggest fucking cesspool on the face of the earth, that are, you know, open about, you know, embracing communism and this, that, and the other. It's like you're tweeting from your middle class white home about the greatness of communism. If you're this dedicated to the cause, pack up and move to North Korea or move to China.
I think one of the things that I think you're perfectly right is that we're in the end of a 10-year cycle of derangement by social media. Now, I have cousins who are 17, 18, 19, and you realize their entire life has been mapped out online. And Generation Z, I guess, which is people born after 2000, they're the first generation, it would seem. I was listening to somebody talk about this the other day, and they said their understanding of the world is informed by people who are their own age.
Yeah.
And whose opinions are instant. Now, when I was 18, I was reading the books that my father had for the previous however many decades. You were reading books by historians, you were reading books from the 1950s, from the 1960s, from the 1920s and 30s or whatever. You were looking back through history. Whereas an entire generation now, because of what social media has done to them, I don't fully blame these kids. You know, I've spent time, as I said, with my cousins the same age, and trying to understand how it must be to literally live in a sort of headline society where, you know, that appeals to the emotional narcissism of the instant nature of social media that affects your way of judging the world and your way of interacting with the world. And because so many of them have had like parachute parenting or haven't been allowed, I suppose, free play, haven't been allowed all these kind of stuff to work out decisions on their own, many of these young people don't seem to be that bothered with lockdown, for example, because I don't think their insular way of looking at the world through this screen doesn't, the idea of liberty and freedom seems something that belongs to another century. And so I don't entirely blame them, But yet, of course, we can't completely absolve people of blame. But I certainly think that when I was 19, certainly I was reading books, not just reading headlines, and looking back through history and trying to actually study history. And I think that very much now, young people want to burn the house down. The mentality is we're here, we're now, we're looking forward, we want to change everything. And being part of a revolution, I'm doing parenthesis here, is appealing, especially in an age when people don't have social groupings, they don't have hobbies. You know, their activism is like a teenage hobby. And so you also realize that you're you have power. 10 of you can get together and get a tutor fired on Twitter because institutions, older institutions, haven't figured out how to deal with this. And because they caved into people for the last 10 years, that's the precedent has been set. And so you it's a really, really strange situation. You realize the generation who have been, like I said, who I don't entirely blame, but who have been indulged, now can wield power without understanding the context of history. And so it's, yeah, it's very, very, very problematic. And I hate
the thing
that
is also, I frequently, I think about if our current age has birthed these fucking miscreants, can you imagine what their kids are going to be like?
It might write itself, so to speak, and they might react against their parents for the things that they did. I mean, again, we can't take ourselves out of the context of how we related to our parents. Yeah. I mean, my grandparents fought in World War II. They were English. And so how they related to their sons and daughters who had the 1960s countercultural revolution, we can't fully blame young people for being within the moment of history that they're in. And you know, so you can't, if you've sat and I say it to my friends now, like, you shouldn't be putting pictures of your kids up online, facial recognition, at least allow your kids to have some let's call it online privacy till they're old enough to decide whether they want to be online. People don't see it like that, because they're just too proud of their kids. They want to show them, here's my kid, you know, kicking a football or whatever. I get that. It's very hard to neuter all of the emotional impulses that social media just constantly provokes within people. I suppose you have to have a form of, as I said, sociopathy to try and disengage with those. I don't know. It's very difficult to, again, what infuriates people who know me is that you find all of the gray area in the middle. I never like the sexy black or white answer. I don't like the absolutism of people who have claims to certainty of it's got to be this. Like, say, for example, the Syrian refugee crisis. We could make, there's been probably 1,000 different points of view on it. But one of the mitigating factors or instigating factors was, it would seem, rain. The weather in the desert in Syria.
Yeah.
It didn't rain for X amount of years, forced people in in the countryside to move to the city. The city was mainly full of Alawites, so there was a religious difference once people migrated into the city. Then they marched for bread. And so I like to go into the really the weeds of the kind of really boring, mundane things that other people don't find as a sexy answer. No, it's the NGOs of blah, blah, blah. It's like, it's also rain not falling in the desert.
Yeah.
I understand most people don't have the, well, maybe they do, they don't, I don't know, the time and space to really analyze everything to the point that it gets into that gray area. But that's part of the reason why we're in the situation that we're in.
Yeah. You mentioned the sociopathy, and I only
say that to a fucking, kind of poke people.
Yeah. But the thing is, there is a point to that, right? So yeah, sure. I often wonder whether, is that the difference between being led by your emotions and being led by principle? Because again, to your point, if you were led by emotions, the first thing that you would have seen, if you thought back to the Syrian refugee crisis, was the kid washed up on the beach, sure. The very famous photo of the, and it's terrible. I mean, I've got a daughter. Sure. I think when you're a parent, Bill Burr said it once, you're going to go through, you're a parent when you frequently find yourself in random situations, just, you know, having to yell yourself down, like, ah, shut up, I don't want to think about that anymore. Sure. You know, so it's a terrible situation. But actually, like I said, if you stick rigidly to principle, then you think through actually, okay, what did this, you know, what actually caused this? But likewise, you know, and what does an influx of refugees into a society that is foreign to them and that doesn't share, you know, that intrinsically doesn't share their culture and values, what would the knock-on effects be on both sides, you know, on the Syrian community and on the community that they've gone into?
Well,
and again, I think that most people, one of the things that I've reflected on over the last couple of years, and I think you've really seen it come out in the last, you know, probably the last 4 or 5 years. I heard some of the other day say people abandoned their principles. I don't actually think they had any principles to begin with, you know, and I don't want to sound like I have, you know, particularly low estimation of the average human being, but I do, because I don't think most people have any sort of thought through principles. You can look at the way that they think about politics. You know, I was raised in a you know, quite a politically you know, tuned in house, in part because, you know, we were in apartheid South Africa. You know, my parents were quite, you know, were quite strongly on the side of reform, changing the country and things like that. And so from a very young age, they started educating me on politics and what everything meant. But one of the things that I always was taught, and I've kind of abided by all my life, is number one, there is no politician that you're ever going to agree with, ever. If you do, something is fucking seriously wrong with you. And secondly, when it comes to voting, you need to assess your principle and your position on all of, you know, on a variety of issues. You know, what are your views on the economy? What are your views on, you know, domestic issues, cultural issues, whatever the case may be. And you align yourself, or you align your vote to the candidate who most closely fits what you stand for. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, well, I think that most people don't. I've kind of forgotten, I suppose, the principle that politics is a game of compromise, and that in a world where everyone is told that the answer is that they are, you know, they're validated for being right, and the answer is either extreme this way or one or the other way, what happens is the middle ground gets sort of destroyed by either by the small percentage on either side who have the loud hailer, because that's what gets clicks. Once you look at a mainstream media, it's been incentivized by clicks. A moderate man says reasonable thing is not a headline. And so, whereas before we voted for, you know, politicians to make difficult choices, but they were either statesmen or stateswomen who understood the breadth of history, maybe now politicians are encumbered by being caught up in memes and Twitterization of, it's, everything is so instant, because that's the society, the atomized society that we live in now. And so I think, like, I often say sometimes, like, I'm politically homeless, which surprises people, but I try and hold the middle. It's just that the middle has kind of been destroyed or been repackaged as elements of extreme from both sides. And so, because it's just not interesting to people, it's not a sexy answer to go, well, actually, I'm trying to hold the line in the middle. On some things, I'm economically conservative. On some things, culturally, I'm quite liberal. I mean, like many people, I'm nuanced. But nuance is not something that delivers clicks. And so we're beholden to a very, very strange moment in society where big tech platforms are bigger than states. Like, if the Irish government wants to do something or other and it contravenes look at Sweden. Sweden decided, no, we're going to go our own way with this lockdown stuff. And the amount of media stories in every other country, we had them here, which were kind of sort of like, you know, look at these traitorous, treasonous Swedes who want their grandmothers to die, this, that, the other. And I knew people who didn't really understand the argument who almost took a little bit of glee from, oh, look, Sweden isn't doing so good. And I was there like, you don't know what you're fucking talking about. Have you looked at the numbers? Okay, they're in the middle of, let's say there's a league table of deaths and cases. They're in the middle. They didn't do as well as Norway. Yeah, true. But there's reasons for that. There's geographical reasons. There's European Union reasons. There's lots of other reasons. You know, ethnographic reasons, whatever you want to call it. But They're in the middle. But what they didn't sacrifice was all of their liberties and freedoms, which now everybody's kind of going, oh, hey, can we have those back? And like I'd said to people a year ago, any nation, city, state throughout history where the people handed over every freedom to agencies of unelected, very often, or elected agencies of power and influence, to say, give me an example of where they got, here you go, here's all the things you gave away back. That never happened, ever, in thousands of years. That's just not the way power works. And this is a complete misreading and misunderstanding of history, or even just a very simple understanding of, like, as a kid in the schoolyard, if you gave the bully your fucking lunch money or whatever, you didn't get to go, hey, can I have that back the next day? It's just, it's a complete emotional misreading of history. So yeah. I've forgotten what your question was by now.
I grew up
also in a quite a political house with a lot of books, and quite different viewpoints in my family. Like, my grandfather would have been quite conservative, but yet fought in World War II against the Nazis and stuff. So he was kind of like, I got a lot of his kind of politics here and there. Then my parents were kind of hippies. And so, but it was always arguments around the dinner table, but always very civil arguments. And there was a lot of different points of view flying around and lots of different books. And so I kind of think we're quite thankful for that idea that, which must have come from somewhere, that being skeptical is the rational perspective. And that's the kind of the way I approach every claim that I meet.
Yeah.
Like, say yesterday, our government announced a whole raft of contradictory measures. And you're just sitting around last night talking to my friend. I was like, yeah, but here's A and B, and there's no point but those two ideals can meet. And I suppose when you are like that as a person, you take it for granted that other people are the same, but you then realize that, like, oh, okay, people are busy. They've got their lives to lead. They don't have time to analyze every single detail. As I said, you're a father and stuff. So I'm not. And so my friends who are just like, I haven't got time for this. But unfortunately, what's happened is that our politicians have decided to hide behind unelected officials, so as they can avoid risk and jeopardy, and just outsource the decision-making. And they've outsourced the decision-making to people who have an awful lot to gain economically and in terms of power and influence over this. So again, I mean, look, there was this Hong Kong flu in 1958?
Yeah.
And the English government came up with a solution pretty quickly. It didn't involve lockdown, by the way. And so did the rest of the world. And it quietly just got on with getting on, because people understood that this was part of the risk and jeopardy of life, which we in the West seem to have forgotten, that that is part of life. Like, 1,300 people die a day in the UK, right? 1,350, 1,400, something like this. There was one Tuesday a few weeks ago where one person died from this. So what were the other 1,299 people dying of? And why is there no outcry about that? Of course, you know, everything in measure makes no sense.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no proportionality to any of this. And if you were going to try and eradicate death by not living, then, you know, it's again, 0% makes no sense. And this comes back to my view on society in general, or of living, in that there is no 0% argument, just like there's no 100% argument. You can't have 0% of this. That's not how nature works. And so anyone who is, you know, campaigning for 0% is either fucking stupid or on the payroll of somebody who has a lot to gain from there being 0%. Sorry, that was another rambling blah.
No, well, it's another thing that's played on my mind recently. So I you know, I'm not going to ask you about your medical, your private medical decisions, but I've been. So I actually had an appointment to get the vaccine done. I needed to change it for various reasons. I've since started to hesitate rescheduling that for a couple of reasons. Number one, you mentioned it earlier, but I'm struggling to understand why the governments cannot provide us with an absolute target to say, when this percentage of the population has been vaccinated, everything goes back to normal.
Yeah.
What is the point of getting the vaccine otherwise? The other thing that you know increasingly concerns me, I literally got a call with somebody an hour ago, and I was supposed to have a meeting with them, and they said, listen, I need to go to the surgery. I had the vaccine on, I think the last vaccine on Friday. And I've, you know, had these spells where I kind of feel completely sedated and things like that. I don't think anybody, they can talk about follow the science all they want. There's no one that's going to be able to convince me that they could have come up with a vaccine this quickly and for there not to be side effects. And I'm not a vaccine skeptic necessarily. Yeah. But equally, people that will point the finger and say, oh, well, you know, you're an anti-vaxxer. Okay. How many flu vaccines have you had? So you know that normally shuts them up pretty quickly. But I actually joked with the guy that I was talking to, saying like, your story is doing absolutely nothing to decrease my vaccine hesitancy, I'll tell you that much. But biggest problem to me is if the vaccine is supposed to work, why do we not know of a target? Why is everything open-ended? I think the Prime Minister of Australia the other day, and I speak under correction, he was asked, you know, what's your target on, you know, how many people need to be vaccinated before, you know, we stop the lockdowns. He said, oh, no, there is no target. As you say, now there's models coming out where saying, oh, in the winter, people are going to pick up this variant and that variant and the variants mutate. So if that's going to be the case, then fuck that. Then I'll wait until the vaccine comes out that you know, handles all variants.
I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to sense make amongst nonsense.
Yeah.
In the sense, and I mean, I'm being flippant, but what I mean by that is you're trying to rationally come to a conclusion based on all of these points of argument. And it is a very rational question. It's like, well, when do we get to a level of herd immunity or a level of percentage of once we've done the risk category, we should have been out. But I've been trying to say this to people is that you need to disavow yourself of relating one of those two or three or four things together. They aren't related necessarily. They are to a degree, but they also aren't. Because if you allow yourself to understand that some of this is about social control, is about cultural engineering, or whatever you want to call it, societal engineering, then having lines in the sand for which we work towards, which are then, okay, here are your freedoms back, because we've reached this target. That's not how it works. You notice the can is constantly kicked down the road because some part of it is incompetence, some part of it is grifting, some part of it is targets set by Big Pharma have just not been met. And the just a simple unwillingness to just release the reins and let society go, to pull the plaster off and go, okay, we need to stop paying people this PUP, to endlessly furloughing companies. It's a whole combination of things. Like, polio, malaria, the vaccines for those have done incredible things the last 100 years. I'm not against vaccines. I mean, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. It's the structure around it. It's the carrot and stick structure that's placed around it. But yet, I said this last September, October, to people like, watch, they'll tell us the vaccines are the key to your freedom, and then they won't give it to you. And people are like, once we get to the percentage, we'll be out. And here we are. We're not. Of course we're not. Because that was never the game. Then again, one thing doesn't necessarily correlate to the other. And so we just keep, it's like we're in a kind of feedback loop.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is Western, not the rest. A lot of the rest of the world, which we don't hear about, is a lot of, as for example, East Asia, Southeast Asia, they're not in this feedback loop. It seems to be a Western phenomenon. Now, that's before we get to anything like the Great Reset and all that stuff of how much of that is a billionaire's talk shop, how much of it is folly, you know, like a Victorian folly or something like this.
When you see BlackRock buying up houses, mate, you start to go, you know, that I immediately that line goes into, you know, pops up in my head, that fucking loser on the World Economic Forum video in 2016, you will own nothing and you will be happy.
Well, there's an element. I mean, if you read elements of Klaus Schwab's book, I mean, I'm not saying I've read his book, but I've read bits of it. And there's one paragraph which sort of kind of stuck with me. And it was just like, the society we have to create is one whereby you don't go out to go running. You go on your treadmill in front of a screen and you pick your destination. You don't go and visit your family. You go on the Zoom call with your family. You use the family WhatsApp group. You don't play sports, you play this, you don't go to, basically you don't do anything human outside that has agency and movement, because it's sold, it will be sold to you as being, you know, against the environment. The environmental choices, the climate choices, stay inside, consume inside, replace all your human activity with the online or insular version of it. And then no one can look at what's happening and tell me elements of that are not what's happening. Yeah. That there isn't an element to turn. I mean, I can see it in my own city. They've been hacking up the city, building outside dining areas. And I was saying, like, are they going to create a sort of dining apartheid here where vaccinated outside, vaccinated inside, or sorry, non-vaccinated outside. And everybody's like, ah, come on, Alan. They're just trying to give them more space to gain the money they got back. And I went, no, watch. And I was fucking right. That's exactly what they're proposing, to create a two-tier society, or three or four or five or six-tier society. Because let's be honest, the vaccine uptake amongst, for example, ethnic and minority groups is very small. So we're literally excluding them even further from the society that we're creating. So the process itself, one could say, is racist. It's all sorts of, like, there are so many things that are so complicated to unpack. Of course, there is also just incompetence and whatever else underpinning, you know, never put down to malice what you can to incompetence is a good byword for some of this. But if the incompetence and malice has the same outcome for you, which is that you have no agency in this world, I mean, look, we can see it in, I can see it in my own city that all of these small businesses pushed to the edge and pushed to bankruptcy, pushed to dereliction. Who takes over those buildings and what happens to them and why? And I have friends who are lawyers who are like, yeah, the small business thing that is in the Great Reset is happening. We know it. We're conveyancing those cases. So, I mean, look, I'm not somebody who subscribes completely to it, but certainly to not know about it and to not try and rationally observe some elements of it. I mean, earlier this year, I went to Roadburn to sing for a little bit, just to talk about music for a moment. And I went to four countries within certain days. I had a whole bunch of tests, PCR tests, this, that, the other. And everywhere I went, I saw cops everywhere, every small business shut, no social society, no civic society, and curfew at 11. And I was just like, tell me this isn't. If anyone who would go from country to country to country and not go, wait a second, just fucking scooping your voice, there's something fucking happening.
Yeah, something's not right.
If you don't see that, you know, you're fucking either just doing an ostrich head in the sand, or you just, I don't know, whatever. Or you don't want to believe it. I understand that also. To believe that your self-worth or your agency, your small business, is not worth anything to these people is a very dark thought. But I mean, look, what you're saying, you know, if the Great Reset, for example, is what it claims to be, then what it's saying to, let's take a city in Europe, Naples, right? The ancient Roman city-state. What it's saying to the people of Naples is, who've been there for whatever, 2000 years, is your culture, your music, your language, your small businesses that you've built through generations, everything that this city stands for is now done over. Stay inside, consume through fear. Don't be human with each other. It's over. Cultural, social, civic society, as expressed by you and not at the behest of health officials and state, is over. Now, that's, you know, that's like the NKVD sitting at the front of the fucking opera with Alan in the box seat. That's an expression of that. It's like basically... Now, I'm not saying that that's exactly what's happening, but to not consider, like, to not at least look into it and go, God, I wonder if they have a point, the people who are pointing this out, and then rationally try and observe what element of it. I mean, look, a gig happened opposite me, the first time anybody stood on a stage in Ireland in whatever, 16, 17 months, and everyone going had to have a test on top of whatever else they had. They painted white squares on the grass, which you had to sit with inside, with an open air stage with 500 people in a place that would normally take about 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000. So basically your public expression and art and musical culture is now at the behest of health officials. So they decide what you can and can't see. And obviously they've decided you can't see very much. And now tell me that's not fucking Eastern European. And it's, that's not like East Germany in 1971. That's exactly what it's like. And yeah. people need to disavow themselves of thinking, oh, it can't happen here, because it is. Now, again, to caveat that with what percentage is or isn't, like I said, again, we're still in a sort of purgatory of knowing or not knowing. And I've begun to realize that maybe the dust just doesn't settle on this. Maybe there's no moment where you go, okay, it's clear now what we do. I'm beginning to think that moment, and I've been thinking this for a long time, this moment just doesn't come. My friend runs a bar, you know, they have a venue in the back of it, and he doesn't know if the gigs that are booked from September on are going to happen. And he says to me, I'm beginning to think I might never know.
Hmm.
What, are we leaving it up to a bouncer to check whether you're vaccinated or not? Or
yeah,
are they retraining people with health official status? Another boring thing for gigs and stuff is insurance. How are all these venues going to re-insure themselves against, you know, one case of something or other? Do they get the same indemnity we gave Big Pharma? It's, you know, to be flippant about it. Again, there's so many banal grey reasons that make all of this such a complicated thing to try and work our way through, that I understand people who just go, you know what, fuck it, Alan, I don't give a fuck. I'm just drinking a bottle of wine every night and watching, you know, Home Improvement, who watches that? You know what I mean? So
Yeah.
It's just that this is like, I was like this before all this happened. For years, I've been like this, oh, like this constant barrage of trying to contact, you know, of thoughts and ideas, and trying to contemplate how all of this fits in or doesn't fit in, as the case may be. So I haven't changed. It's just that basically the part of the world where I was allowed to just do my own thing is gone.
Yeah.
So that's why I seem more, it's like you sort of, it's like whack-a-mole or something. My head's popped up more often than not, as usual, or something, you know, above the parapet. But like we just said, it's, you find that plenty of other people just aren't, they don't seem to be willing to poke their head above the parapet even a little bit. And I understand that the jeopardy is quite considerable when, you know, somebody who'll watch this and go, he said one thing I disagree with, etc. So, but I don't know. Maybe no one fucking cares. I don't know. That's also true.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm fortunate with my podcast, and hopefully you are with yours too. I can, hand on heart, and hopefully it stays this way, I can say I've never once had anybody give me any shit about anything that I've said. I can see what my demographic is as well. You know, hopefully within that demographic, I don't have any fucking social justice warriors or anybody trying to get me canceled. I had someone once say, I had Nick Sagius from Drive of Pazuzu on, and, you know, we went down, you know, quite a lot of different rabbit holes, including quite a bit about politics. And, you know, someone said, oh, I hope you don't get canceled. But yeah, outside of that's the closest I've literally come to any sort of criticism, because at the end of the day, I'm with you. I'm a free speech absolutist. I prefer having people that are, you know, prefer being friends with people who have different opinions to what I do.
Yeah. That's what society used to be, you know.
I don't begrudge anybody the right to an opinion. And equally, I concede that, you know, certain people need to think in a certain way or need to have certain aspirations. You know, I'd much rather talk to somebody about trying to find a middle ground and saying, you know, we might have differing views on the economy, but ultimately we're all trying to get to the same place. What is the middle ground there?
I mean, look back at something like Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley or something, and look at their the incredible Best of Enemies, or whatever you call it, documentary, and look at the debates they had. I don't think that'd be possible in today's society, even on a micro level. Like, of course, lots of my friends disagree with me about this, that, and the other, but the idea that you can't talk to people from whatever varying degrees, like most people will find out when they talk to me, like, oh, that I have some incredibly liberal or left-wing views about some things, you know, culture, sexuality, all those kind of things. But then I have other ideas that they would say are conservative. But that's what, as I said before, being human is about. It's a nuanced point of view. I don't belong to your tribe or any tribe. I just belong to my tribe. And I try and evaluate what I see within each, the merits of each ideal, each stance, and try and not be driven by an emotional reaction to those things. Or to, you know, if somebody makes you angry, they own you. Now, I can't say that I'm not notwithstanding sometimes a bit angry and post things every now and again. I mean, look, it's like Grandpa Simpson fucking shouting at the clouds, you know, posting on Facebook.
Yeah.
It's just a middle-aged bullshit talk show. But sometimes you have to throw something out there, but I certainly don't do it like I used to do 10 years ago. But at the same time, again, I always just say the same thing. Skepticism is the rational perspective. And if you aren't a skeptic, then you aren't rational. That's kind of how it is to me. I mean, I do understand. Let's say if we talk something about the health service, right? Health service executive. There's a certain amount of game theory that goes into the health service executive, you know, like something like the prisoner's dilemma idea. They can't tell you all the truths because they understand how panicked the public at large would be, because a great percentage of the public are not rationally skeptic or can't really handle the truth. So they're in
I was just about to say they aren't emotionally equipped to handle the
So I understand they're playing a game where they're trying to spin elements of the story, but it's a difficult game, and so they've spun it too far, of course, in relation to this, in my opinion. But at least when I speak to people, say, about this, and I go, well, if we understand that, say, something like there's a game, an element of game theory within the announcements that come from politics and the health service, then you know it's a game. Mm-hmm. So let's get over the idea that we accept every part of it as truth. Let's dig down into what that statement is. So that's the problem I have with people, is that trying to disavow them of the idea that they're not being lied to, or they're not being, let's say more pertinently, you're not being told the whole truth as opposed to being lied to. So once we start off from that perspective, which is skepticism, not cynicism, I'm not a cynic, so to speak. I think that's an important intellectual distinction. And once you start off from that point of view, that's how you view everything. Like, I would have the conversations with my own mother. She'd talk to me about something and I'd go, well, what news source did you read that from? Look at the headline. How many times did they mention this word in the first three paragraphs so that you're being emotionally led to believe that? You know, who is the writer? What's their background? Now, I understand not everybody has the time to do that kind of stuff, but they're quick things. And then she goes, yeah, I see that. Now you see, look at the picture that's been framed within that story. Now that's how I look at everything.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the same way.
And always did, you know?
Yeah, I'm exactly the same way. What really set me off down that path actually was the second Iraq war, because it was right around the time that I moved to the UK. And I remember when things were getting in full swing, I looked at everything and there was just something that said to me, this is bullshit. There's something about this that doesn't smell right. And then, you know, obviously we don't have to go down that road, because I want to talk about music a bit as well. You know, lo and behold, you know, 20 years later, you know, the US has spent $9 trillion on a fucking futile, pointless exercise. God knows how much money has been wasted by this country. I mean, our military is down the pan as well.
But anyway. What you've said is a good example, because you can use that line, WMDs in Iraq.
Yeah.
Again and again and again and again through the media. So when I say to people who don't believe there's another narrative at play now, I say, remember the Iraq war and you were told weapons of mass destruction, and how the media, you know, connected Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, who were on opposite sides of the religious Sunni Shia view of Islam, but they connected them. I said, how many narratives were at play there? You accept that there was a deceitful narrative, so to speak, for which was the precursor of that. Now apply that same logic to this and think of the war there, which the war for resources is now an emotional war to implement a health tax on the world. Could that be true?
Yeah.
And it's you know, to me, that's a very easy argument. I call it like a cul-de-sac argument. It's like, I think about it. I think about ways of, it's not very nice, I suppose, but of entrapping people within an argument that there is no escape from, because you cannot deny the logic. So either you react angrily or emotionally, but you cannot, at least, you know, not 100%, but like it's difficult to argue against that, because there wasn't any weapons of mass destruction. So anyway, no. Sorry. Yeah.
So as we segue into the music industry, you spoke on your last episode on Agitators Anonymous about the Matt Heafy example of how he's making way more money on Twitch than they make through streaming. There was something I'd read where they'd interviewed Derek Green, and he was talking about how, you know, the streaming revenue that a band like Sepultura make is, you know, it basically boiled down to it's unfair, it's too little, etc.
Yeah.
So in this kind of new milieu, how do you think it all plays out for you know, our scene? You know, do we get to a point where bands are going to just all have to become like Mugwa and sort of disappear underground and pop out with an album every now and then? You know, what do you see happening? And do you think there's anything that the music scene can do to insulate itself or to not insulate itself, actually, to guarantee its longevity?
Well, I mean, look, let's be clear about a conversation about the music industry. It revolves around the pandemic, whether we like it or not. I mean, if bands are not able to tour and play live and there are no festivals, there arguably isn't really a scene. I mean, I started a band to be in a room with people, not in a room without people. It's very simple. And like, if there's no more touring or playing live, there won't be any more Dread Sovereign. Maybe there'll be one more Primordial album, but, you know, but there's no reason, essentially, apart from, okay, the artistic impulse of creating, but then you make it and you are literally, you become a statistician, just watching numbers move up and down online. And that's not why I started playing music. And I would say, I think you would see most bands that you love and know disappear. You'll get young bands who still want to make music, who don't really understand the parameters of what's happening. But the Rotting Christs, the Marduks, the Mayhems, the whatever, take away playing live. I can't see, exactly. But there's no economic principle behind continuing without playing live. I mean, 99% of musicians, just like the percentage of people who aren't affected by the virus, don't make a living from playing music. Sounds a little a flippant comment. But without playing live and touring, that's the kind of the percentage where people make their little bit of money.
Yeah.
And you take that away. So every conversation about the music industry right now has to be caveated with, if live music doesn't return, I mean, I don't know how a scene supports itself, because also you're probably saying then, like, in Ireland, they can't play music inside because it promotes dancing, laughing, people talking nearer to each other. I mean, you know, who didn't, you know, the Taliban didn't like live music either.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, if this kind of nonsense stays, you're talking about, there won't be metal bars, there won't be nightclubs, there won't be anywhere to go and hear music. What sort of scene comes out from that? Is it just a scene of guys or girls just sweep picking, writing music over Zoom? I mean, if that's the scene, then I'm not part of it anymore. So I don't know. If you mean financially, I would just say to people, the only equitable site is Bandcamp.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm not saying everybody has to always, but try and buy your stuff from bands' merch stores. Because the streaming, the money you get from streaming. I mean, somebody like Matt Heafy is a good example. I don't begrudge the guy anything. He's made a very clever cottage industry out of being who he is, to an audience who were young, who then grew up following him gaming and playing this. And he wakes up and he makes his coffee and goes, okay, we're going to do something today. And he has his audience. Good for him. But you can't expect, like, musicians who've been doing it for 10, 20, 30 years just to pivot to that, to try and gain a few hundred quid a month. And it takes up all your fucking time. Like, and also people wanted to make music within that time. And you're also you've taken away, for me, I don't really, you know, I mean, I like being in the studio-ish, but the movement, the traveling, the playing live is the reward for the effort that you put in within the studio. And so take that away, and it's hard to see the purpose. I suppose it's the same as, well, it's complicated, because being a traveling musician is probably like the last thing that's going to be theoretically let out of the pen here. Like, it's, you are the last in line. I don't know.
Yeah.
even somebody who paints or, you know, an artist can have an exhibition online, and painting is a solitary pursuit. You write a book, you do it in solitude. Now you're missing your book tour, your interviews, your whatever, but you can still do that online, I suppose. But playing music and being somebody who has to play live and have that sense of, you know, communion, whatever you want to say, humanity involved in it, when that's taken away, it's very hard. There is no replacement for that. And I see it in our arts council here. Our arts council has no one like me on it, obviously. More's to the pity, but they are talking about, you know, building streaming sites in every city, so bands can come in and stream for free to their audiences. And you're thinking, this is entirely like, what band is forming to just stream?
Yeah,
there's no rehearsal rooms in every city. You should be building a non-profit based live venue, 200 to 500, which any band can book for free all across every city and town in Ireland, to create an environment. You can stream from there if you want also, but you should be encouraging people to come out to see a band, not encouraging them to not have any humanity in the process of making music. But I understand there's probably some people there who are well-intentioned, who just think this is how we have to pivot or else we have nothing. And we also have to present proposals to get our funding, et cetera, et cetera. But what you're doing is promoting an anti-human agenda, which is what I keep saying, to try and get people to go, oh yeah, the idea that you form a band to rehearse on Zoom with each other on a screen like this, to then maybe meet to stream to an audience you've created only online, to have no human process in it, is a dystopian nightmare for music and art. And everybody who's trying to promote that should understand that. And like I said, there's many people involved in the situation that we're in who are the unwitting handmaidens or the unwitting servants, foot soldiers for maybe a broader agenda, which is what we've been discussing, you know.
Well, in the communist revolutions, they were called the useful idiots.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I know you've read up a lot on history, that we know what happened to the useful idiots when everything was said and done.
Yeah.
Is a streaming show or doing some sort of stream anything that that Primordial was tempted by or entertained? Is it something you would ever think about doing?
No. No. we might film. I could see us filming a rehearsal in the round, and discussing the songs and like a sort of more human element to it, which was sort of like, here you are in our rehearsal. But as for putting on all the stuff and standing on stage and pretending as an audience, no, never. I would rather lose a digit than do that.
Which doesn't surprise me, by the way. I rewatched.
No fucking way. And you also notice how few bands are continuing to do it. There was an enthusiasm for it. And like, I don't begrudge bands who do it. Like Oranzi Pazuzu made a good one. The Rotting Christ one where they did it, the old songs, was cool. Catatonia did a cool one. I don't begrudge bands do it. I'm just, not for us. But also don't forget, in Ireland, we had no choice anyway because we couldn't go inside to stand on a stage.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like there was some, you know, kind of somebody goes, hey, we've got a stage here, blah, blah, we can go to it. Like we had people at a 5 kilometer radius from meeting. Anyway, that's besides the point.
Yeah.
But I don't begrudge bands who want to do it. I get it. You want to do something to try and hold on to some element of being a creative person. Like for me, it was the podcast, I guess. But no, I won't do it. I would rather, I don't know, wait it out for 3-4 years until it comes back. I mean, I don't know. Like, I hear stories like, hey, there's a big festival in Germany next summer that is talking about antigen testing 18,000 people every morning.
What?
Yeah, before they're allowed into the main arena.
I was about to say, so the first band is up at 9 at night. Testing starts at 6 in the morning.
See, look, I mean, I understand that the whole situation might change in a month or two or three, but they're trying. I get it. Festivals are desperately trying to do anything to happen. But, you know, in this, if we believe that a percentage of some of this is about altering social culture, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, remains to be argued about, then the idea of 50,000 people gathering in a field from all around the world isn't part of that. It just isn't part of the reset vision of social and civic society. And so the idea that, you know, all of these festivals are going to happen next summer and be allowed, if there's a new variant, if there's this, that, the other, I mean, it's unlikely. I hope to be entirely wrong, believe me, because another year of no festivals and touring will be a social circuit breaker. I think until we get to next spring, you know.
Sorry, just bear with me 1 second.
Yeah,
this,
yeah.
This dog is, there's stranger danger. Bailey, out. Anyway, I was just going to mention an observation. I recently watched back the brutal assault clip of you doing As Rome Burns, and I mean, I can't see you being someone who would stream because the connection you have with the audience is so visceral and so intense.
Yeah.
And actually, side note as well, As Rome Burns was a song that kept on popping up in my head every time I read the news for the last 15, 16 months. It's like, you know, Alan knew. that should be the t-shirt. Picture of your face, Alan knew.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people have been sending me bits of my own lyrics. And I mean, I didn't quite think this might be it. But, you know, it's, again, all the lyrics throughout all the years have been imbued with my skeptical perspective of history and trying to get to the sort of dark underbelly of the machinations of history and trying to pull the screen back or pull the curtain back a bit, unveil some of the things that maybe have been moving or grinding the gears. And certainly the same mentality that wrote the lyrics is observing what's happening now, you know? And by also, I have been saying this in the podcast, by my own admission, people have to allow me a certain leeway to have lost my mind or to be angry and frustrated and be over the top and be hyperbolic when maybe it's not necessary, because I'm still my own flawed human shell, you know, observing these things. And sometimes I'm privy to my own miscalculations. But that's part of being, trying to hold the line in the middle, is that I'm not saying that my view on all these things is always absolute, because of course that would contradict my view of all of these things. Even my own views, I try and caveat them, as I said, with a kind of like, look, I could be losing my fucking mind here, but this is what I see. So you're not the first person to say that to me. The truth is,
I was about saying I would imagine it's a very surreal compliment to be getting. It's like, hey, listen, we're in the end times, and you know, I really feel like your lyrics captured it really well over the years.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah,
I know you're pressed for time, and as am I. So I want to kind of just ask one final question. You know, aside from Agitators Anonymous, any plans with Primordial? Any of your other projects imminent, or are you kind of waiting for things to kind of play out in whatever shape they do, and then you kind of make a decision from there?
I mean, look, Primordial started rehearsing new songs last September, and then everything got shut down again. And since then, we haven't met each other. Like I said, once the kind of circuit's been broken for a while, it takes a while to start the machine back up and move towards writing songs again. So there's every intention of making a new album next year. But the thing about it is that if Primordial had a new album ready this year, I wouldn't release it. I wouldn't waste an album on this year. I already wasted a Dread Sovereign album because we couldn't sit on it anymore. About, you know, my other thing that I'm doing that is meant for playing live, like the whole music is designed for that purpose. Take that away, it's just a good, you know, doom and roll, whatever you want to call it, album. But with Primordial, even if it was one ready, I would go, nah, we're putting this back a year or whatever, or 2 years, or... Because to be selfish about it, there's nothing in it for me. Mm. There's no agency, purpose, movement. There has to be that as the sort of, you know, the moving in tandem with actually just being creative. So there are lots of gigs announced for next year. I guess like everyone in the industry, we're just sort of in a kind of purgatory waiting to see what's possible. I mean, again, like I said, it might be that my most negative impulses about how the cards might fall might be incorrect, and it might be okay. It might be fine. You might have venues which just go, just show your card at the door, in you go, you know, and that there isn't anything more than that. Now, of course, that in itself has other issues, but again, like everyone, it's really difficult to know. Like I said, this festival that I've heard is planning that as just anything to get the event through the authorities. You can see Hellfest have announced a lineup that is so huge, they're basically daring the local authorities to cancel them.
Because that
is a lot of money for that region pouring into the area. And they're basically saying that we're going to make this festival so huge, we dare you to cancel it. Now, what we've seen over the last 18 months, and this is one, you know, coming back to something you said very early on, and one of the things that's really shown to me is that art and culture means fucking nothing, literally. There's been no lobby that's been able to crack this open, especially in a country like Ireland, where our government and the politicians lean into Irish culture, history, art, writing, playwrights, poets, music. They lean into that when they want to. They've done literally nothing but throw money at people. Okay, fair enough, but economics is not it's not the reason why art exists. You know, that's not economics, that's just business. And that's clearly, you know, the sort of the contradiction at the heart of you know, an arts council who just basically only has an economic impulse to try and throw money at the problem while giving people no artistic agency to deal with it. You know, I know that maybe it sounds weird to some people that you don't treat the two things as the same, but it's very hard to, again, like everyone, I think all of these industries are just kind of in a kind of form of purgatory. So I don't know, really. I mean, no one really does. I think even if you take something really as mundane as, well, not as mundane, something we took for granted as touring. If every European member state is moving at different speeds in relation to all of these processes of vaccination, different rules, different laws, I mean, passing from one country to the other, you need a PCR test or an antigen test. If you have to have a different test moving into every country in Europe in tour, there's no touring. It just doesn't happen. You can't, at a cost of what, €1,000 a day for everybody in the van or the bus to go and get tested, wait on the results, miss a day, arrive, do the venues ask for your proof of this, that, the other? Like in Ireland, they're proposing that you're going to need this antigen test on top of whether you're vaccinated or not to gain access to even the pub. So how does anybody go to a gig spontaneously? You just don't. And so imagine going, you're in a van full of people and you're going from Holland to Belgium to Germany, whatever. And let's say you get one false positive in that van, tour's over. Mm-hmm. So you can't plan for anything. You can't book a van 9 months in advance and they show up at the airport. And let's say, and airlines are going to do this. The government is going to say, hey, these are our rules. It's not up to us what the airline does. And the airline are going to go, you have to go over there because we need to make the money back we've lost from the previous 2 years and get our rapid test for €50. And let's say you get one false positive, drummer can't go. What the fuck do you do? That's really boring, mundane reasons why I think most people haven't thought about when it comes to music industry, where they haven't thought about and gone, oh, right, yeah, insurance and, you know, what survives coming out of this. And also just like traveling, that they're really simple, boring things, mundane things. People go, people will always want to see live music. And I go, sure, okay.
Yeah, because the demand is there, being able to supply to the demand might not always be there. So
no, and I mean, like I said, one of the things that's crystallized the last 18 months, and then we can wrap it up, is just like somebody said to me, Alan, why do you give a fuck about the theatre? You never went. And I go, why give a fuck about theatre? Because it's one of the oldest artist expressions known to us as people. Let's fucking draw a circle of sand. You act out something in the middle, we'll watch. This is one of the oldest artistic expressions and a cornerstone of our cultural civilization. That you're just saying, oh, why do you care if it exists? I care because of those reasons. And if you are so divorced from culture and art that you don't care if that exists, then we're fucked, you know? And whether that's live music, writing, You know, I'm one of those people that think art is more important than creating a 0% risk-averse society.
Yeah, I agree.
So, because that's a society I don't want to live in.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah, and again, you nailed it earlier when you said, you know, 0% at the cost of living your life. You know, it's always the trade-off. And again, I don't necessarily think folks think that through properly. But yeah. Alan, I so appreciate the time. Absolutely awesome talking to you. And, you know, love to at some point in the down the road do it again.
Yeah, sure.
You know, likewise for me, I was such a huge fan of Exile Amongst the Ruins. I would hate for there not to be another Primordial record. So
there will be another one. I'm pretty sure about that. You know, as long as I don't, you know, get us banned and cancelled in the meantime. No, there will be another record. Like I said, my worst version of what might happen, I'm not married to. We just have to see what happens, you know.
Yeah. But listen, take care of yourself, and we will speak again very soon, I hope.
All right, Chief. No problem.
Bye bye.
And that, my friends, is the end of episode 66. If you got this far, well, you deserve a Medal of Honor. The show is sponsored by MetalBlade.com. Go and use the promo code ALAN and you will get 10% off your order. www.hatecouture616.com. HATECOUTURE 616.com. Go there and also use the promo code ALAN and you will get free shipping. And last but not leastly, Eisenwald Records. www.eisenton.de or .com. Use the promo code ALAN and you will get 10% off your order. Thank you for paying attention to this long episode, but I thought that the conversation was too good and too intense to not use as an episode of Agitators Anonymous. And it also got me out of a hole after spending a week off the grid. All right, go and fire synapses, my friends. Planet Satan, over and out.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.